Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
That does sound really good, but it also sounds awful.
Well, and what is it? I'll tell you what it is, dear listener. Thanks, James. Sorry, I say two words and you're
already having a go at you.
Okay, what? Which is that? Basically,
just
that,
do it again. Go on.
It's Japanese for Achtung. And yes, it is. Okay, well, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, the World War II podcast for the chaotic digital non-linear world.
And hello, wherever you're listening. I'm James Holland.
And I'm Al Murray. Now, if you're listening on the day of release, and don't worry, no one's keeping score. You can listen whenever and wherever you like, the miracle of the podcast. But if you are listening on day one, this goes out, what was going on in Normandy about now?
Well, interesting times. Rommel has met with Hitler at Margeval, which is this kind of huge bunker for the Führer that's been developed in kind of eastern France, which he only ever uses, I think, once. The plan is that he's then the next day, on the 18th of June, he's going to go and actually visit the front in Normandy.
Blimey.
But a V1 goes a bit wrong, and one of the doodle bugs, and lands not a million miles away, and he thinks, oh, no, that's a bit risky, isn't it? Probably shouldn't.
Just I'll go back to the Berghof. Imagine if he'd gone forward and Ultra'd found out.
Yep.
And, you know, the way they put a hit on Rommel,
yeah.
just imagine.
So, to be honest, it was probably the right decision. But at that meeting...
Well, for him.
What Rommel is saying is...
For him.
Yeah, I mean,
steady on there, James.
Yeah, obviously for him. don't put me in that bracket. I'm not a Nazi.
You heard it here first, folks.
Well, I'm not a Nazi.
How many have we recorded? He's finally making that clear.
I've finally come out.
But
what he is saying, what they are discussing, what Rommel is saying is, please let me retreat in stages, which is what the Germans have always done in Tunisia, in Sicily, in southern Italy, and what makes most military sense. And one of the reasons why Rommel is so keen to retreat is because Hitler is saying, no, you've got to fight for every yard. You've got to stick as close to the front, the Normandy front, as you possibly can. An established bridgehead has been connected together by the Allies by this stage. And what Rommel's saying is, while we're this close, we're within range of all those offshore naval guns that the Allies have. It's just completely insane. Yeah. And Hitler just goes, I don't care. You've got to stay fighting to the front, which is why the Germans continue to fight so close without giving very much ground at all, which in turn is one of the reasons why Montgomery then gets criticised for not making more progress. But actually, you know, he's got Hitler to blame.
But I mean, suppose Hitler might be looking at the situation thinking, you know, Rommel saying, well, we need to fall back. And Hitler thinking, well, that worked well, didn't it? You know,
well, in Sicily and Tunisia, not.
Exactly. It hasn't worked so far. So why bother?
Well,
and in Russia, on the Eastern Front, they try shortening their lines, or they try punching salients out, and they try doing all that sort of thing. Don't work either.
Well, there is an alternative in surrender.
Well, of course, surrender, to throw the towel in, but that's not going to happen either. So it is, I mean, it is this sort of, is it never impossible to get your head into how Hitler's making his decisions anyway? Maybe he thought, well, I've listened to you guys so far and it worked.
The other point is that Normandy is the only place up to that point in the war where all three services come into play. And okay, yeah, the Luftwaffe is massively reduced, the Navy is massively reduced, but you know, they have got these Type 21 submarines coming into play, you know, sooner rather than later. Actually, as it turns out, not till April 1945, but you know, they're in the once those U-boat bases have gone, they've gone, you know, you're not going to get them back anytime soon. So suddenly, you know, Normandy is of far greater strategic importance than Tunisia, or indeed, and also the, you know, the and also the,
but if it, let's say let's let I mean and one of the problems here also is that Hitler's assessments of things come from, I mean, last week we talked about bad intelligence. Hitler's assessment, it's not just bad intelligence, it's the fact that no panzer division or army group commander in the German army is going to go, well, I can't do that, you know, don't be ridiculous. Yeah. Sorry, boss, you know.
Well, they do put up quite a bit of...
They try, especially when it starts going very wrong, they try to. But the point I was trying to make was that the political significance, if you did force the Allies back into the sea, if it did work by holding close and fighting them, the blow that would generate politically is enormous, isn't it? And that's Hitler's way of thinking. It's about you know, you talk about shock and awe. People talked about shock and awe in the Second Gulf War. A great deal of the Nazi political thinking and sort of military is about striking blows, knocking things down, creating effect. And you look at Operation Lutich, which comes later. That's about striking a blow. And I always think Lutich is like a really interesting precursor to the Ardennes offensive. It's the same thinking.
Absolutely.
We put on a big show, we knock them over, we make them think again, and all that.
It buys us time.
And it buys us morale at home because if it's going well. Whereas, you know, Hitler may have thought a series of defeats is politically unsustainable at home. And of course, the thing that changes his position politically enormously is the July bomb plot, which then completely changes the complexion of how his command structures work, how he motivates morale in Germany, how people, you know, that there's finally been a public attempt on his life, and you Germans are basically told to which side are you on, or asked which side are you on, quite forcefully, and that complete, you know, once that in a way there's a window until the July bomb plot, isn't there, where maybe he could change his mind, but after that, there's no way he's going to change his mind.
And not anyway,
fight every inch, and which leads to the Falaise Gap.
Yep,
directly.
Yeah, completely. But on the 18th of June, you know, so that's the day after Marjorie. That's the day that he would have been visiting the front, and he's now not. I mean, the British and the Americans and Canadians are still building up their forces, and you know, they're a bit worried actually because the weather's continued to be bad. They're behind schedule on what they're building up, and obviously it's still vast compared to what the Germans have. But the Germans are still moving their panzer divisions forward. You know, their 17th Panzer Grenadier Division has reached the front by this time. You know, heading upwards is the 1st, 2nd, 9th, 10th SS Panzer Divisions. They're all kind of heading towards Normandy at this stage.
As you said the other day, I mean, or just 10 minutes ago, if you're listening to a previous podcast, as you said recently, they're being written down from the air. They can only move at night.
Yep.
There's nothing they can do during the day. The railheads have all been destroyed. You know, because we've had Point Blank already, all that happened.
Yeah.
So.
But Monty's under huge pressure to kind of mount a big offensive.
Yeah.
And when I say Monty, that's because he is overall land commander at this stage. Yeah. And he's going to attack Round Col. That's his plan with the British Second Army.
Villers-Bocage has happened, right?
Villers-Bocage has happened, but we won't talk about that because it's just a minor little incident of no importance. And he's trying to build up forces to do an overwhelming attack. He knows that at some point the panzer divisions are going to have to mount a coordinated counterattack.
Now,
and the plan is to get into them before they have a chance to kind of.
So is this Operation Wild Oats that gets dropped?
Wild Oats gets dropped. Yeah, this is the kind of through the kind of
So the uninitiated Operation Wild Oats is the sort of it's an first airborne division who are a strategic reserve who famously then end up squandered at Arnhem. First Airborne, they're put on readiness.
Yep.
They're going to capture the airfield outside Caen, aren't they?
Carpiquet. Yep.
Carpiquet airfield. There's going to be a swing round that, there's the Roman road, isn't there,
yep,
that Villers-Bocage is on. And the idea is they're going to pivot round Caen and take Caen in a sort of dashing...
Because there's this gap that's emerged between the 12th SS Hitler Jugend Division and the Panzer Lehr.
Yeah.
Because they're the first two major new units that are arriving at the front. And there is this gap. And so the 7th Armour Division, which has landed on D plus 2-4, I think, is pushed straight forward in their Cromwells and Shermans, and they're pushed forward. And the lead element reaches there on the morning of, I think it's the 13th of, of June. They're in there and they're liberated the town, and everyone comes out and cheers and all the rest of it. And by just complete fluke, there is Schwer Abteilung 101, which is a heavy Panzer Battalion 101, which is leaguered up the night before, commanded by our old friend Michael Wittmann.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, that's a bit of an opportunity. I'll go down there and shoot them up.
Yeah.
And that's basically what happens. And actually, he would have had his tank knocked out very early on in that gauge, had it not been for the fact that the six-pounder anti-tank gun that was pointing directly at him at that moment, the gunner, the guy who was actually on the gun, was having a slash.
Yeah. The way things turn on these tiny moments. But Wild Oats didn't happen.
That's
a proper name for an operation now. Wild Oats didn't happen because Tedder nixed it, didn't he?
Yeah.
And Monty called him a gutless bugger.
Yes.
Which I just think, because, and they didn't like each other. Just need to fill the listener.
Didn't like each other. It goes back to North African days where Monty, after Alamein, really started to kind of go from being, you know, everyone quite liked him to start off with, but what turned into this sort of ghastly egomaniac, prima donna, and sort of telling everyone around and thinking he was God's gift, and he just put everyone's back up. And, you know, and Tedder and Cunningham never really, Cunningham was commander of the 2nd Tactical Air Force by this point, Tactical Air Commander in North Africa, never really forgave him for that. And they were just not quite singing from the same hymn sheet. But the big problem was that they just hadn't got quite enough. They hadn't got enough there quickly enough to do it. It was always just an absolute outside chance. The whole Wild Oats one. Yeah. It was, you know, it was dependent on far too much everything going according to plan. And as everyone knows, the first thing that doesn't happen is the plan goes to shreds.
You've probably been looking at another awful battle where 1st Airborne Division was torn to pieces. Is the, you know, I'm afraid.
Yeah, probably.
And you look at, I mean, famously, this is the 17 cancelled operations before Market Garden.
Yep.
They're all totally nuts. Yep. And you think, God, you know, do people any idea what they're proposing here?
Yep. And then the second plan was to kind of just push everyone through across the bridges of the Orne and the Canal, move into that kind of the old drop zones for the 6th Airborne, and push up to the east side of Caen and go around that way.
Yep.
Then that was abandoned. Then what they really wanted to do is do a 3-corps attack. And if you think a corps is kind of 3 divisions, divisions like 15,000 men, something like that. So they wanted to do 3, and they were 3 divisions behind and build up.
Yeah.
And that was made worse by the great storm happened on the 19th to the 21st.
And that more really than German action at that point. The storm is the thing that intervenes in Allied plans.
Yeah.
More than full stop, more than anything else, because it wrecks the American Omaha.
Yep.
Mulberry.
Yep.
And really does sort of bouleverse plans. And the you know, it's all very well getting into who's tactically better and all that, the stuff that you might read elsewhere. But that storm is a massive material blow to Allied plans. Full stop.
So 2nd Army is supposed to attack on not a broad front, but on a very concentrated front, you know, with these 3 corps. And in the end, they have to launch Operation Epsom on the 26th of June with 2 corps, 1 corps on the main attack and the second one, Martlet, on the side the day before around Fontenay-le-Pesnil. And they have to do this because they know that these panzer divisions are massing, and what they can't allow them to do is mass themselves into any kind of...
Sort themselves out.
They've got to kind of chew them up as they come in.
Catch them off balance.
So Epsom's already got a lot of things going against it before it's even launched. Also, the weather is really taking a turn, which means the air power can't come into play in the same way. So actually, Epsom achieves a huge amount because it does... absolutely kicking to touch once and for all any chance of a German counterattack. I mean, you know, after Epsom, there is not going to be a reverse in Normandy at all. I mean, it's unlikely before, but it is absolutely...
Certainly never going to happen
afterwards. And actually, it achieves quite a lot.
Right, well, there we are.
There you go.
Snapshot of the...
Well, that was also quite free-ranging, wasn't it?
Just that little bit. Right. Chris Patterson, who's found us on the We Have Ways hashtag, says, not the email, the wehavewayspodcast@gmail.com. He's not used the email because he's not old. Is it true there was a Korean guy who fought for the Japanese, the Russians and the Germans, and when is the movie of his life coming out, asks Chris Patterson. Is it true?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, it really is. In fact, actually, Anthony Beaver started his entire D-Day book with this. With this story, he was. I think he was. No, he was fighting against the Japanese, I think, and then was captured by the Japanese, right. Was then captured by the Russians, fought with the Russians, then captured by the Germans, fought with the Germans, transferred to the West, captured by the Americans, sent off to a prisoner of war camp in the United States, and that's where he stayed for the rest of his life.
Right.
So
founded KFC
ending.
Or something.
It had a happy ending. But there were all sorts of sort of weird stories of people. And actually, when I was sort of scouting around looking through the amazing Imperial War Museum photo archives, looking at all the Normandy stuff, and they've got zillions of photos there. I came across, I can just show you the picture of this little chap here. He's actually a 10-year-old Russian wearing German. I'll put this up.
What?
But he is Nikolai Pankov. A Russian. The boy's father, it says on the back of the photo, was a lieutenant in the Russian army and with his mother was killed by the German invaders. He was then looked after by a Russian soldier. This Russian was then captured and transported and compelled to fight for the Germans, and he took the boy with him. And Nikolai was eventually adopted by the German 3rd Company 990 Grenadier Regiment and became their mascot for 14 months.
Jesus Christ.
During which time he was dressed and trained to take his place beside the German soldiers at the front. He was then captured by the British on the 17th of August. And there he is. Actually, to be fair, he doesn't look any worse or wear for it, does he, really?
No.
But amazing. 10 years old, wearing little, you know, and he's got one of his, you know, the classic German field caps. He's got his...
That'd be a great Where Are They Now, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I wonder if he's still alive. Nikolai Pankov.
He could be.
You know, it's very much, you know, we had all sorts of people fighting for the coalition forces, the Allied forces, and the Germans had all sorts of people fighting for them. I mean, you know.
Cossacks, all sorts.
Yeah, French, Alsatians, they had Norwegian, Swedish, Dutch.
Yeah.
And there's that Belgian guy who Hitler said, you know, you're like a son to me.
Yeah.
What was he called? De Grel. Yeah. Leon de Grel.
Yes, because I've read Guy Sagier's book, who fought Alsace German on the Eastern Front.
Yeah, great book.
It's a great book, but such a weird story. And all the Germans regarded him as a Frenchman. You know, they were suspicious of him. madness. Right. Okay.
And there were of course Indians as well fighting for the Germans.
Yeah, and a Muslim outfit from. Bosnia, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so lots of different people, and you know, I can't stress it enough. You know, you most of the action in Nazi Germany might have taken place in Europe, but this really was a world war.
Yeah.
You know, and it really did involve people and dislocate people from all across the planet, and that's why it's so incredible, and it's such a incredible period of unprecedented global human drama. I think.
Yeah.
And why it continues to fascinate.
Yep. Alan Callow asks, has Eisenhower been underestimated as a field commander, especially at the Bulge? He seems to have been brilliant. But most works talk only of his political skills. Well, he wasn't a field commander, was he?
He wasn't a field commander. It's interesting because I was talking to Rob Citino. He's a very, very brilliant American academic, done an awful lot of work on the German armies in the Second World War and further back, actually. But we were talking about Eisenhower just the other day. We were standing in Grosvenor Square, kind of yarning about Ike. And actually, I think, you know, he's got all the attributes, really, to have been a very, very good field commander because, you know, he understands that operational level. He understands air, land and sea and how they coordinate together in the kind of Allied way of war. He's a brilliant administrator, a brilliant planner. He knows instinctively as he progresses up the ranks that you've got to let go and give your subordinates some leash but you know, use their initiative and all the rest. You've got to enable them rather than kind of restrict them. You mustn't micromanage. You know, he does that brilliant line about you know, every time I read something, I want to kind of rewrite it, but I mustn't let it be rewritten. It's their words, not mine. As long as the essence is correct, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
You know, so he gets all that. And he is a brilliant, brilliant diplomat. And I can't really see why he would be a poor field commander. Although, I would say, of all the ones to use as an example, the Bulge is possibly not the one.
No, that's
actually probably where he was his absolute weakest. But yes. I think, by and large, I mean, I'm a huge admirer.
Completely misread the situation. Yeah. Completely. And also, said it the other day, or maybe 50 minutes ago, depending on when you were listening, the Ardennes is the high ground that you need to get to dominate the Meuse. And And the fact that the Germans came through the Ardennes in 1870, in 1914, Sedan, and they tried to do it again, and they do it in 1940, and they tried to do it again in 1944.
Yeah, through the scene of Hitler's greatest triumph.
Exactly. I mean, come on, right? I mean, I think, I mean, it's quite interesting that the Allies sort of don't don't. I mean, they fall into the trap again that we've talked about with D-Day, where they expect the Germans to fight the kind of the way they have before, and also the kind of the reasonable the way you would rationally, which is in normally they expect them to fall back in a retreat and to better positions, and they don't. And by the end of 1944, what they're not expecting or imagining the Germans are going to do is try and do some sort of hammer blow thing, like they gamble thing, like they do in the Ardennes. They don't see it coming because it doesn't make any.
It doesn't make any real military sense.
Any sense at all, right? Because if in the end what you're trying to do is defend the Reich, you don't. Try and seize
But it is absolutely the German way of war. Attack is the best form of defense, the Hitlerian way of war.
You know,
it was, but it's also the Frederick the Great way of war as well, and the kind of Bismarck era kind of way of war as well. I mean, you know, there is a long tradition of the Germans using kind of attack as the best form of defense because defense tends to get attritional. You're not going to win because you're in the middle of Europe and you haven't got access to resources and you haven't got access to world's oceans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a kind of sort of warped logic to it. But there isn't much logic when you're absolutely fucked and not going to win the war to do a counterattack in winter, in the snow, in the Ardennes. It doesn't really make a huge amount of sense.
No. It makes no sense at all. But that's Eisenhower's mistake.
This is a mistake. I'm misreading the kind of the intelligence traffic. And, you know, Bradley's the same. They both kind of fall for that one. But I think I have enormous admiration for Eisenhower. I think he was a really, really great man. So we got another one here. Big D says, where was the German Navy on D-Day and how important were spies like Juan Puyol García, also known as Garbo Alaric?
Well,
that's a two-pronged question if ever there was one.
Well, the German Navy on D-Day was saying,
do we have to go out there? Okay, we're in our S boat. Okay, we can do 50 knots. So let's just make a dash right across the Bay of the Seine.
I mean, the German Navy was there and did what it could. But the big hitters of the German Navy were holed up in Norwegian fjords, hiding from 617 Squadron.
Yeah, sort of rather underlying the kind of mistaken policy that they'd adopted in 1938 with the Zed plan of kind of trying to build a large surface fleet when, you know, a small fleet is much, much more sensible of U-boats and surface vessels and stuff.
Yeah. So the German Navy basically, where it was on D-Day, was either at the bottom
but
of the
But they did sink stuff. To be fair, the Luftwaffe came and sunk ships out in the night and S-boats did come out and, you know, torpedo ships and stuff. Yeah. They did go down.
Yeah.
And they were a pain in the arse. But I have to say, have you, there is one S-boat left, which is Kevin Wheatcroft is slowly but surely rebuilding down in a boatyard just opposite Plymouth. These things are so cool. I mean, you know, I just so want to see one being out on the sea again. They're seriously quick, 50 knots. I mean, that is going some.
For them, that's very fast.
It's the same old thing because you can see the woodwork on this. Some bits of the kind of surface of, because it's being rebuilt. So you can see parts of the original woodwork. And it's just, you know, it's shipbuilding engineering on a kind of scale which is just impossible to mass produce because it's so complex, it's so skilled, it's such a thing of beauty that you can never kind of mass produce them in any shape or form.
Yeah.
So of course this is why they don't ever have very many of them, but those that they do are absolutely brilliant. So Juan Puyol García, absolutely. I mean, you know, he's key to it. He has something like, I think, 22 fake agents or something.
That's completely fictitious.
I mean, he's absolutely amazing.
They
play great. Well, because we win the intelligence battle before D-Day.
And run out of a flat in Hendon or somewhere, wasn't he?
Yeah, somewhere up there, up North London.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Collindale, that's right. A flat in Collindale. So whenever I drive around the North Circular to the M1,
I think of Garbo.
Right, well, the referee has blown his whistle for half-time. Hang on, I've stumbled into the wrong podcast. James and I will be back in a moment.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. I thought we might have a chat about something raised by one of our listeners, Jack Waterhouse, who asks, is it true that we had brilliant espionage, or is that just propaganda on our side? Hashtag We Have Ways. Because that's the hashtag if you want to get in touch. Well,
yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did. Although we did have disasters. So,
of course.
What happened in the Netherlands, where basically everyone was rumbled.
Yeah, and SOE in France, they had those big circuits that were kind of knocked out, and they had them running, and Germans knew exactly what was coming in. So Violet Charbeau and people came in and got immediately captured, tortured, executed at Ravensbrück, etc.
Yeah, because the thing is you know you have, for instance, in Holland, when the whole of SOE being sprung, is that you had a portion of the Dutch population who had been kind of sympathetic to some of the political ideas doing the rounds in the 30s, if it's one way of putting it. And so it was always, I mean, these things are incredibly difficult to organize and to put people in. And in France, obviously, as well, you have people blowing hot and cold the whole time.
Yeah. Well, the development of the French resistance is just so interesting because, you know, some things that you have for resistance to work, and one of them is hope. There has to be a sense that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that you're going to end up on the right side. And this is a case for any civil war or anything that throughout the history of mankind. And, you know, up until, you know, late 1942, 1943, you know, there isn't an awful lot of hope. And, you know, everyone's so shocked. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? We were talking about sort of Dunkirk and stuff the other day and you know, how many Frenchmen were lifted, you know, loads of Frenchmen lifted, and most of them chose to go back to France because they thought, well, you know, it's all right, I've got an armistice, you know, how hard can it be, you know?
Yeah.
You know, all Europeans together, you know, lots of people kind of fed up in France of the kind of 13 different governments or however many it was, coalitions, the kind of rise of the communists and polarization and populism and all that. You know, maybe a better bit of strong arm leadership is what we need, actual fact. You know, at least I'll be safe, at least I won't be dying on the front like last year. I won't have to sort of, you know, drain my blood over the fields of Verdun. You know, so you can see why people did it. And of course, if that's your kind of collective thought process, then it's going to take time for resistance to build up.
Yep.
And of course, resistance is going to be disparate. It's going to be little pockets of it all yep. over the place. And, you know, this is where Jean Moulin comes in, you know, yep. the most famous resistor of them all, because he's the one who's originally going to go to, he's a prefect in the Loire district, gets put in prison by the Germans for kind of being forced to say that some people who were killed was actually killed by French colonial troops when they weren't, and he knew it. So he's tried to stab himself to death. That failed. And he then decided to kind of emigrate to the US. And as he's getting into Spain, and he's suddenly thinking, actually, maybe I can do some good here. So he then goes and sees the British in, I think, Lisbon, gets sort of vetted, gets taken over to Britain, gets briefed and all the rest of it, and goes, okay, right, send me back into France. I'll go on a fact-finding mission. Goes back into France, does this fact-finding mission of kind of seeing what's out there, how you can sort of coalesce resistance. And he, although he's very, very left-wing leaning, and General de Gaulle, who is the commander of the Free French base in London, is very right-wing, Jean Moulin says, look, we've got to have one focus.
Yeah.
And really, just in the interest of the war, we can all think about our politics after the war, but just we've got to all be as one. Yeah. And we should really fall behind his Cross of Lorraine flag. And this is what we should do. And he's the one who actually starts getting all these disparate units, these different resistance movements to start working towards together. And it's not really until kind of beginning of 1944, really, that there is a kind of coordinated, proper sense of there being a French resistance that can really actually do something. And, you know, everyone's a bit sniffy about the French resistance, says, oh, yeah, of course, they're French resistance. You know, everyone's a resistance in 1944. But it was still absolutely horrific, because there was also, conversely, there was the Milice. And, you know, and Klaus Barbie famously said, you know, I only had a few hundred men, you know, when I didn't need any more because I had hundreds of Frenchmen doing all my work for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that was absolutely true. And it's very, you have to remember that for every resistor, there's a kind of, you know, there's a pro-Axis, hardliner, anti-communist.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are pro this because of this fear of the West, and you have it in
the south of France, you have a lot of people, communists who've escaped Spain from the, people left over from the Civil War, hold up in the south of France, which is Vichy, of course, and then where do they fit into that picture, the resistance picture there? And you get these incidents where you've got the Spanish communist resistance people working with left wing French communist people, and that whole political element. And of course, and we've talked about this before. If you're a proper Comintern communist, you twiddle your thumbs until July 1941 anyway. Because the Nazis are friends with Stalin. So you haven't picked a side yet.
But it's really interesting. A lot of the resistance movements develop out of self-flagellation by the side. So in the case of Italy and in the case of France, what happens is the French Vichy government says, right, all French young men have got to go and kind of do national work for the Germans. Exactly the same thing happens in Italy. Right, all Italians of the kind of, you know, 1924-25 kind of consignment, they have to go and join, you know, the SS police force or the kind of new neo-fascist divisions of Mussolini all go and work in Germany. And everyone sort of goes, you know what, I don't really fancy that. I'll run to the hills and become an outlaw. And suddenly you've got a kind of, you know, you've got a vast amount of people who are angry, who are kind of living in the shrubland or the mountains of the Apennines or the Maquis, which is why they're called the Maquis, who are prepared to kind of, you know, resist.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of self-inflicted wound from the point of view of the kind of host, you know, the Italians, fascists, and the Vichy French. But anyway,
what have you got there?
So again, another little digression from Garbo, but so here, this is my kind of my thing for the week. This is a Zold book, and this is what every German a member of the armed forces would have, and this is his kind of like his identity card. It is his pay book. It's everything. And these are where you would be issued your uniforms, and you get these dockets, and you get them. If you lose it, you have to, your pay gets docked and all the rest of it. And this is an original one. And I just think it's interesting because every time I look at it, I just wonder what happened to Andreas Dietermann. And it's got all these different details in it. You can see he joins and when he joins on the 20th of May, 1942, he's born on the 8th of February. 1909 in Essen, which of course gets very badly hammered by the RAF.
He's quite old then.
He's quite old, which is why he's coming in late. So he would have been your classic guy who would have been in a factory in Essen, almost certainly.
Yeah.
And is pulled out of the factory because they need more manpower and is replaced.
Is replaced by a disgruntled French bloke or a displaced Russian or whatever.
Yeah. And he's blonde. Ukrainian. He's got blue eyes. He sounds the kind of Aryan, you know, absolute prototype. Yeah. But, you know, here are all these Nazi stamps. And whenever you look at them, they just, it puts a little bit of a chill down your spine, I think. And at the back of it, yeah, here you are.
God, look at it.
Look at them all. And at the back here is some other stuff, including some Reichsmark. There's a 5 Reichsmark note. There's various Ausweiskarte. You know, this is a kind of sort of travel pass. A Hafenzeitausweis. You know, an Ausweis is a pass, isn't it? A kind of, you know, so 4th of July, 1944. So still around then. It's just this little tactile link, isn't it, to someone who was real. You know, this is not a black and white photograph. This is a real person. He's an MG. He's a machine gunner. You know, and I'm a massive believer in, and here, I don't know what this is, another pass, Andreas Deichmann, signed by whoever it is, Oberleutnant and Komptführer.
And this is stamped by Captain Hauptmann H. Kampf, something. Yeah, so it's the chief of the camp.
But I just think it's, you know, I think it's really, really important as a historian to actually not just sit at your desk looking at books, but actually to get out there, walk the ground, feel stuff, look at tanks, fondle the barrels, but also kind of look at uniforms and look at little things like this. So, you know, it tells you a lot, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It puts a person right in there. And also, you know, it's a glimpse of a culture, isn't it?
I had a friend who was a baker in Dusseldorf, who fought on he was twice wounded on the Eastern Front, then eventually captured in Northern Italy, a chap called Franz Marson. And every time he got wounded and lost his jacket, he'd then go for a replacement. And they go, right, that'll be docked from your wages.
Right.
I mean, Jesus, can you believe it?
Hair blonde, Augenblau, blue eyes, like you say.
And there's his, and there is his military career in that little kind of thin paper booklet.
Yeah.
And everyone had one of these.
Mother's mate, your wife's maiden name, Cecilia, born Ludwig. Extraordinary.
Yep.
Zum Feldherr abgefangt von. So he's in the infantry. So, I mean,
well, that's an Ersatz battalion. So that's a training battalion.
Yeah. I mean, it's the other thing is this. A lot of this, dear listener, is in extreme Gothic type, that not only is it in German, but it's in this sort of heavy Gothic type that's actually quite hard to read if you're not accustomed to it. What an extraordinary thing. Impfungen, here we go. Italy.
Yep.
Wow. I do wonder what happened to him.
Yeah, don't you?
He's had his... there's a page of the inoculations he's had.
I mean, it is literally everything.
Typhus, paratyphus, cholera.
Yeah.
So it's a snapshot of...
And it needed all of those in Italy.
Yeah. Snapshot of a soldier's life.
Isn't it?
And where did you get this from?
I can't remember. Someone gave it to me. I think it was given to me by Oliver Barnum. He's a collector. His father actually was a Spitfire pilot in Malta called Dennis Barnum. And Oliver is actually, he's the only person to have restored a Japanese tank. So we're talking about last week when we were the other week when we were involving.
Of course you know someone who's the only person who restored a Japanese tank.
But anyway, I think he gave it to me.
That is quite.
Would I be interested in having one of these?
That's quite the thing.
Yeah.
And he's got that in his top pocket wherever he goes, isn't he?
Yep, it fits in there. Yep, there it is.
Unbelievable. Well, time for us to bed down in a barn. But before we go, 2 quick plugs. If you haven't yet bought James's brilliant book on Normandy, Normandy 44, why not? It's essential homework for the pod. Please read chapters 1 to 3 by next week. I'll be asking questions.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Al. And if you fancy coming along to see us record the podcast live, we will be at the Chalk Valley History Festival on the 29th of June at midday. And we'll be taking your questions and answering as many as you can. And just so you know, Chalk Valley History Festival is about 10 miles southwest of Salisbury. It's a completely safe city now. It's been cleared of any kind of dodgy toxins. Chalk Valley itself is absolutely beautiful, and it's a lovely place. And that weekend, oh my God, it's going to be great. There's so much going on. We've got, who else have we got apart from you? We've also got Dan Snow coming, Neil Oliver, various other people, the great and the good.
Basically, anyone who's
the D-Day darlings,
anyone who's got a history book out but isn't able to get a plug for it on this podcast is going to be at Chalk Valley History Festival.
Yeah. And we've even got stuff that's nothing related to Second World War. Amazing.
Oh, my goodness me.
I know, can you believe it?
Well, in the meantime, please do contact us on Twitter using the hashtag WeHaveWays. And it really helps if you subscribe, rate and review us on whichever podcast platform you use.
Yep.
That's goodbye from us then.
It is.
And it's
Cheerio.
Ask me the same from him.